Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. In our first hour, we're talking about the environment, and people ask questions about Aboriginal spirituality and the dreaming and its impact on our understanding of where we sit in the world. Well, in this hour, we're going to hear from a rock legend for whom that's been most of his life. Shane Howard, Goanna Band, Spirit of Australia, and their hit single Solid Rock. In the early 80s, Shane Howard became an iconic figure and still is in Australian music. This week, he releases a new album, saturated with some of those ancient themes. And we're about to meet Shane Howard to talk about the songlines of his life and their latest expression in his album, Goanna Dreaming. That is a little reminder of Solid Rock. And on Sunday night, it's a pleasure to welcome the man described as a quiet but passionate rebel. The writer of the song we've just heard, a legend of Australian folk and country music, Shane Howard. Shane, welcome to Sunday night.
Thanks, John. Great to be with you.
Shane, you've been an integral part of both the musical and political landscape in Australia since 82, when Goanna released Spirit of Place, that iconic album with the old DC-3 flying over Uluru, and Solid Rock became an anthem. That album embodies several themes that remain with you. Social justice, the environment, the first Australians. Now, for some, that might seem like a surefire losing trifecta.
I think history has proved that correct. But, it's ironic that Solid Rock, which, you know, it won, threw me headfirst into Aboriginal Australia and also into, you know, mainstream Australia. There's a kind of bizarre irony there. I never thought that song would be commercially successful. History proved otherwise. And, I mean, fair play to our generation. I think people were ready to... Look, at one level, it had a beat and you could dance to it, and it had a major record company behind it. That's on my worst days. On my best days, I think that maybe our generation was ready to really embrace a deeper appreciation of a history and Aboriginal, the injustice that Aboriginal people had suffered, really. I grew up in southwest Victoria, and Aboriginal people were a fact of life for us. We had the old Framlingham Mission out the road and the Lake Conda Mission to the west of us. What I saw in that reality was dispossession and all the manifest tragedy of settler culture. And it asks, inevitably asks some big questions about, you know, is Aboriginal culture alive and well? Are people still speaking language because they weren't at home, that had all been lost? And that journey inevitably led me to Uluru. I was looking for something. And I guess I saw that at the time, back in 1981, as a kind of pilgrimage of sorts.
You also indicated back in 81 something of what's happened to Uluru. It's become the subject not just of a spirituality, but of a commercial marketing endeavour, which has seen it placed at the centre of Australia's image of itself in both the shallowest and the most profound terms.
Yeah, this strange duality that goes on. Look, I was there last year with... been working with the children out at Mutajulu and Docker River and Imampa communities, illustrating a children's book of Solid Rock. So Solid Rock keeps coming back to me in many, many ways. A young group called the Street Warriors did a hip-hop version last year. But being back at Mutajulu, you can't help but be struck by the fact that there's a five-star resort. There's a beautiful cultural interpretive centre. But just round the corner is the Mutitjulu community, where all the hallmarks of a third world country are manifest. But it's hidden away, it's out of sight, out of mind. You know, and this is all at, like you said, at this this iconic landmark. The closer you get to Uluru, the bigger the story becomes. And, you know, it was a pilgrimage in 1981 for me as a naive young bloke. And I was very privileged in many ways because it wasn't developed. There were still dirt roads out there. I went to see, you know, the community the first morning I was there to ask permission to walk, because I didn't want to walk around places I wasn't supposed to be, and met with one of the old senior traditional men there. And it was a very beautiful encounter, and it taught me a lot about respect. And the whole time I was there, I was watched over by the community in a very gentle way and reassured that I was welcome as a visitor, not an intruder. And the other powerful impact for me was going to an Inmar, a corroboree, on the western side of the rock about 4 days later. And there weren't many white fellas there, and a group of people from Armada and the Musgrave Rangers were camped there, and it was the Dance of the Seven Sisters. And it was just a very powerful, sublime moment where, at the moment, you know, at sunset, as the dancers started singing and dancing, painted up in the firelight, full moon rose over the back of Uluru at that moment. And it was an incredibly powerful, choreographed moment. And I guess I say I woke up in the dreaming, and it set me on a journey that really, you know, and into the solid rock, that song that changed my life.
It's interesting too to think of somebody coming out, as you say, of Western Victoria, and an image of Aboriginality that's confined around missions like Framlingham, in which you see a culture headed towards destruction, not through self, but because of what the situation has done to them. Simply the physical destruction of a culture and the spiritual destruction of a culture, broken into bits. And you go out to the rock and you see a culture that is still whole.
Well, although I read Bill Harney's books, you know, he was the first national park ranger out there in the 50s. And even back then in the 50s, you know, there were still those old people who were trying to keep the practice alive. But even then, it had been fairly corrupted and neglected. And really, traditional culture is hanging on by its fingernails, as is traditional languages. You know, there's a lot of talk, John, about reconciliation, and rightly so. We need to address those things. But there is, for me, there's a sense that our mainstream view of reconciliation is reconciling Aboriginal people to our mainstream way of thinking, you know, our settler culture way of thinking. And I feel, and I guess one of the things I want to address with this album is the notion that we need to dig a little deeper and apply a little intellectual rigour. There is actually a whole Aboriginal philosophy at work, and a cosmology that owes nothing to Socrates and Plato or binary dualism or any of that stuff, that was successful for 30 or 40,000 years. And we approach it at this very low level, when in fact there's a really high philosophical and theological dimension that I don't think we've really vigorously engaged with yet.
Well, in fact, one of the reasons we've got you here tonight is that you are about to release this new album. And not only that, but your collected lyrics from 30 years of songwriting have also recently been published in book form. So I guess what we should do is go to a track from that new album, Earth Is Singing.
The moon goes down on this sacred ground. The tribe is quiet and laying down. Fires are low and the stars come close. Don't talk too loud, it'll carry on. Thank you.
Earth is Singing from Shane Howard, a new album, Goanna Dreaming, about to be released. Shane, that song encompasses something of what you're reaching for?
Yeah, it's really in many ways, John, the backstory of that trip to Uluru where I wrote Solid Rock. So it's kind of, yeah, the story of being there at that time and what followed from that for me, which has been an incredible journey. I grew up pretty much in a Christian tradition in an Irish Catholic household and community. My parents were very, very devout, but they weren't pious. But inevitably, I reached a point where Aboriginal Australia took me on a journey that made me question, I suppose, a lot of the Christian foundation, because the missions and all the implications of that stuff in Aboriginal Australia had, in many cases, had devastating consequences. In other senses, they probably helped save a lot of people from annihilation. There's a great story up in Milangimbi of, I think it was an Anglican mission, and when they built the church up there when the missionary first came, and then the men were dancing one time, doing business, and the minister came down and wiped his foot through the sand painting and said, "This is all finished now. It's devil business." And the following Sunday in the church, the old men, lawmen, came in, painted up, and they speared him there and there on the altar. And of course, people came from the Anglican Church in the wake of that, and there were consequences. But inevitably, it led to a kind of fusion where, in Milangimbi, where there was an acceptance of Christianity, but traditional law was still practiced and still is to this day. So there's this strange dualism of the stained glass windows containing sacred objects and sacred dilly bags and things like that. And at Easter, someone plays the role of Judas and Jesus, and that's all acted out with traditional warriors. So those things are very fascinating.
And you're suggesting that's more than just a trivialising of both traditions in what's been loosely described as gum leaf theology. You're suggesting that in places like Milangimbi, there's been real pain associated with coming to that point.
That's right, and there's serious consideration of the sacred value of both those traditions. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting.
I'd like to return to those themes shortly. Let's talk more generally for a moment. You are using music in a way that's been common for thousands of years as a vehicle for communication about issues, that songs are more than love letters. They're perhaps one of the most effective tools of messaging that civilization has produced and continue to be so.
Well, I think a lot of song in history has been about memory, and that's very true. I know of my cultural background, my Irish cultural background, the deep well of Irish song is all about, which was an oral tradition too, passing on of information. And that's very true, absolutely true of Aboriginal society and the whole notion of song lines that, and there's something about the form of song that enables it to be easily remembered and transported. And I think that, I very much see myself in that kind of tradition.
I guess it's broadly called the troubadour tradition. Perhaps it was best represented in Australia by the late 19th century balladeer tradition, Lawson and Patterson and those people. I somehow get the feeling from your stuff, Shane, that you'd prefer that it's Lawson's image that was still on the $10 note rather than Patterson's.
I once talked to Manning Clark about that, about the difference between Lawson and Patterson, and he said to me, well, in the shearer strike of 1891, Lawson would have been in the sheds with the shearers and Banjo may have been on the veranda with the property owners.
Do you think there is a genuine Australian sensibility that's reflected in that dichotomy?
I do. I mean, look, you'd like to think that we're beyond the world of class structures. I mean, I think they've shifted and changed. I think corporations are probably the new kingdoms now. But there is a residue. And, for all the failings of our generation, I think we've also done some great things. We've crossed religious boundaries, we've crossed cultural boundaries, we've crossed racial boundaries, and we have some gains to be proud of for all our losses. But I think there is a residue of that class structure, and hopefully, you know, I'd like to think that we're on a journey to overcome those sorts of definitions and boundaries and get beyond. And maybe I was hoping that we'd see a republic before now. I think that's an important part of that journey, to really put our feet down into this earth and go, you know, this is who we are, this is where we are. Let's look at all the ugly aspects of our history and go, this is part of the story, sad though it is.
It's still contested turf, though. I mean, we had the broad argument over the apology, but at an even deeper level, one of our greatest traditions, sort of mateship, was co-opted in the culture wars. I mean, John Howard, I think, quite effectively, and I would think quite deliberately, used the iconic image of mateship in the culture wars and appropriated it to his vision of Australia, whereas traditionally it had been owned by the progressive left, if you would like to say, in Australia. And that's also true of things that are close to your heart, like Eureka.
Well, exactly. I mean, the word digger came from the Eureka and from the goldfields, and, you know, then I guess was exported and adopted in places like Gallipoli or during the First World War in France and wherever. You know, and Manning Clark, who I'm very drawn to more and more these days as I go back, talked about Australia, you know, basically becoming a nation of conformers masquerading as mates and egalitarians. And I suspect that maybe that's where John Howard was taking us with that appropriation, of where he kind of reinvigorated a kind of a culture war, and also the kind of putting down of this notion of, let's not look back, you know, the black armband view of history, let's not look back at that stuff and let's be proud of our achievements. And I don't see any reason why those two things can't coexist. Of course there's great things that we've achieved in our settler culture, but there's also terrible things. I mean, you can't overlook the fact that the wealth and prosperity that we enjoy in Australia basically came on the back of unacceptable misery and loss for Aboriginal Australia. And I think we've reached a point of maturity, surely, where we can talk about those things in a mature way and reconcile the both.
It's recapturing, as we began at the start of this bit of the conversation, the idea that the troubadour tradition is not about songs as soporific, but as songs of provocative reminders of the deep things of a culture.
I think there's room for fun. We mustn't leave that out too. I mean, we don't want to get too pious about it. I mean, and, you know, music plays a lot of roles. One is the joyful mysteries, you know, and that sometimes it's just for dancing and for having fun. In the Irish tradition, there's three forms, Gantry, Gultry and Suntry. You know, Gantry is the jigs and reels, your goods and chattels, you know, the stuff of life, the daily life. Gultry is more the ballads and the storytelling, and then Suntry are the lullabies and the more reflective dimensions of the airs, the sorrowful mysteries. And I think that's all a part of music, it's all a part of life. There is sacred song too.
Increasingly threaded through each of the songs on your album, and clearly threaded through this discussion, is some notion of spirituality, even as far back as Solid Rock, which we talked about. Your lyrics were littered with biblical and references, phrases like promised land, sacred ground. Even Solid Rock itself have a biblical resonance. That spiritual resonance seems to embrace three traditions, and you've referred to them: Aboriginal spirituality, you know, your Irish Catholic spirituality, and environmental spirituality. They seem to be sort of, those strands seem to fit very comfortably together, and then somehow are working their way through your own mind as you work through these songs.
Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe it was, you know, that early sort of Christian tradition. I don't know why I've had such an interest at a spiritual dimension, but that's the way it goes. I tried rationalism along the way a few times, but it keeps falling apart. You know, I read Dawkins' book, and I read, which I found very dry, and I read Michel Onfray, who is a great thinker, contemporary French philosopher, you know, the Atheist Manifesto, which I think is a more coherent work about atheism probably even than Dawkins. And the problem with a lot of atheism is that it can become as fundamentalist as a lot of the extreme elements of religion. But inevitably, there's a dryness to it all. If we... And look, I don't have any answers, John. I know it's a life of questions. And
but there are what you seem to be saying is that there are resonances here which we can't ignore, because they just, the drumbeat keeps on, or the echo keeps on.
What is it in humans, what is the hunger in humans that there even be a God? There's something going on. All the cultures, all the peoples of the world are drawn to a notion of the other, the greater, the spiritual, something beyond, the altruistic drive. And, you know, he talked about the environmental dimension. I mean, one of the great failings for me of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism is the environment. And, you know, I mean, Genesis says, go forth and subdue the earth. And, well, we did, and we have, but what do we do now? And there have been some great people, I know, like... Sean McDonough, I think, in...
Yes, who we had on the program just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, who was in Sydney, and who's a great thinker, and my sister turned me on to his book, To Care for the Earth, back in the 80s, and, you know, was one of the first voices really talking in the Christian tradition about the environment and obligations in a spiritual context.
And is it an accident that McDonough comes out of an Irish tradition which reaches back beyond Roman spirituality to a sort of that Celtic spirituality which seemed to have an earthiness about it?
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, John O'Donoghue as well. And it's interesting that, like you say, the Roman influence never reached to Ireland. And, you know, maybe there's something in that. So the notion of centralist government never made it there. And so that
it's why you're all so anarchic. Get organised.
Keep it regional. look, and there's definitely something of that thinking that is in the DNA. For me as well, I think in many ways, I did my time in the urban setting, but inevitably I was drawn back to regional life, and I am still a bit of an advocate for regionalism. I think. You know, and the great thing about the digital age is that you can be a regionalist and still interface with the entire world. That's an upside. But again, that oral tradition and an earth-based tradition, you know, in the Celtic world, and I suppose that is what draws me as well to the elements of Aboriginal philosophy. There's a certain kinship there. And I look at both colonised peoples. They were and both oppressed peoples, and yeah, there's a lot of identifying going on there.
And they're both grounded. That is, for both of those traditions, it starts with the earth. It starts in the appreciation of creation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some of the early Irish poetry, you know, from the 6th century, is very, very beautiful and very compelling. It's almost modern poetry to read it in this day and age, in its thinking, the notion of closeness to earth and that spirituality and the abidance of the earth are very interwoven. And so I think it probably does make sense that a fusion of Christianity and environmental concern would come from those sorts of areas. And I think that's true probably of most Indigenous cultures.
Mm. Let's have a little sort of echo of that in your song. From the new album, Goanna Dreaming, a small creed occur, don't give up on us.
we're all alone, not sure where we are. Get so lonely here on earth, adrift in the universe, given a garden so beautiful. But we've made a mess of things, got distracted. It's hard to stay focused when you have free will. There's room for trouble there. Self-awareness is such a burden. I know you must be. You must be very disappointed. But don't give up on us. Don't turn your back on us. I know we made a mess of things, but we're just foolish human beings. Don't give up on us. Please don't give up on us.
Don't Give Up on Us, from Shane Howard's new album, Goanna Dreaming, about to be released. Shane, give us some insight into that song.
The doubting agnostic's prayer, I think. I guess there's a dual.
Help thou my unbelief.
In many ways, it's kind of calling to the great creator spirit, and at the same time doubting that there's anybody there to listen to us. If you can go online at the moment to the American Museum of Natural History at the Hayden Planetarium, and on that website there's about a four-minute video that begins at the Himalayas and then slowly rises up out until you come back away from the Earth into space. You see all the satellites that are going around the Earth. You come back to the Moon. You go further out to the solar system, beyond the solar system to the Milky Way, out beyond the Milky Way. And it progresses all the way out to 17 billion light years away, which is as far as we've mapped, and then returns to Earth again. And my little daughter, who's 6 years old, yeah, when I showed her, she as it slowly returns back to Earth, you know, this insignificant little dot in the universe, she said, we're nothing. And all those questions, is God, if we believe in God, is God the God of the world? Is God the God of the solar system? Is God the God of the universe? How big is space? I mean, science has taken us so far into an understanding of the physical reality of the universe that it's very hard to believe that God made the world. It's very hard to believe that even our mythologies and our dreaming stories, or that God made the world in 5 days, 7 days, or that two brothers or two sisters created the world. You know, science has taken us almost beyond that. But I don't necessarily believe that that negates our desire and usefulness for mythology and dreaming stories.
Yes, it's almost as though those dreaming stories are the mythologies. Take that sort of giant cosmic dimension and give it back a sense of intimacy.
Because it's too big. It's incomprehensibly big for the human mind. You know, I love, because the other thing that science does by, like what I was describing with that video, is it doesn't diminish the sense of awe and wonder. But
you need the intimacy as well.
You do, and I really love, in Southwest Victoria, one of the Aboriginal dreaming stories is about the Milky Way, and this is a place of many waters here. There's a number of rivers. It's a swampy, marshy area that borders the sea. And the Milky Way is in many ways a river of stars. It's a river that manifests in the heavens, and at night time, all those fires are the campfires of the ancestors camped along the river. I tell my children that story. I think it's a beautiful notion that the ancestors, the people who have gone before us, are up there watching over us, and they're seeing us. They're watching us being stupid, doing the wrong thing or doing the right thing, and that our little lives are observed and you know, not necessarily judged, but observed.
We're almost out of time, Shane, but just before we do, let's can I drag you away from contemplation of great things to the grubby world of the marketplace? There is another issue that seems to me bedevils your music, the question of genre. Some of your music fits the country market. Much of it gets labelled as folk, a category that once included top-selling bands like Goanna and Red Gum, who we mentioned. These days, however, the entire category doesn't easily make it into commercial playlists. Is there a problem here that musicians genuinely face, and what is it, industry bias, political correctness? It just doesn't seem that these days the sorts of music you make and want to make and feel compelled to make can find a niche that 20 years ago was quite openly there and available.
Look, I long ago gave up on the commercial world, I think, John. I saw that commercial success and in the days of Goanna, and it's a profane world. It's morally bankrupt in many ways. Not to say that it hasn't brought us great art too. And, you know, was it any different, say, the time of the Medicis? I don't know all. I find it easier to exist in a world of independence as an artist.
Yes, but it's independence with barriers set against you. It's not as though you're playing independently on a level playing field. It's that the whole industry is geared against accepting the very category of music which you want to produce. So it's not as though you can get there on your merits.
No, and it does, like I said before, it makes you wonder, is this how it's always been through history? How many voices did we not hear? How many paintings did we not see? How many songs and poems did we never hear about? But, you know, time sorts a lot of things out, and I think that's why the folk tradition is so important, because, you know, the victors write the history, but the little people write the folk songs that maybe go on to live in a different way and to be remembered and carried on in a different kind of context. There's a huge corporate machine at work in the music industry, as in most of modern life, and it's far too powerful for me to take on or challenge. But, you know, we have seen the rise in the last, say, 20 years of, you know, the folk festivals, alternative voices being heard in different ways, and you've got to be very resourceful. But it's a hard road. It's a struggle all the time. And but look, you know, Van Gogh never sold a painting in his lifetime, and most people would be hard-pressed to tell you the name of somebody from his time who was a politician or a successful businessman. But we all remember Vincent.
Shane Howard, it's been great to talk to you.
Same, John.
Real privilege to have you with us. Now, your new book is simply called Shane Howard, Lyrics, and that's available, and your album, Goanna Dreaming, will be available too, and through the newest tool for getting the word out there, the internet, so they can go to your website, can't they, and find out the details.
They can indeed. ShaneHoward.com. Don't forget the AU on the end, or you'll end up with a fellow in Texas that is not me.
ShaneHoward.com.au. It's that easy.
It is.
Shane, let's have to finish with. Yeah, you mentioned the sense of optimism in Gantry, Guntry and Sultry. I think I've got that right still, haven't I? The three sort of Irish forms of
that's
expression.
Right. That's right.
Despite the pain that's so often described, there is a deep sense of optimism that comes through your music. Perhaps the best word to use is hope. What is that hope vested in for you?
I don't think we have an alternative to optimism. Kenneth Clark, in his book Civilization, said we can destroy ourselves just as effectively with cynicism as we can with weapons. And I subscribe to that theory, and I just think Manning Clark said that the road of suffering winds slowly uphill from loathing, anger, hatred of self and hatred for everyone, up to the top of the mountain where you look down really with the eye of pity for everyone and yourself, even those who mock you. And I think, you know, that's part of the journey, is to try and get to some place of grace and some place of forgiveness, compassion, mercy, all those values, and love. Love is king, and you know, we have to be optimistic, or we will we're headlong to extinction. So,
and occasionally take a moment to dance a jig.
Let's have a dance.
Shane Howard, the final song for this evening. Thanks for joining us with Oh Life.
I'm gonna wait for you by the riverside, by the mountainside, on the sunny side, where clear waters flow and the big trees grow. And the time I spend isn't wasted in a blaze of foolish thoughts or troubled doubts. I spend my time watching nature do what nature does so well. No heaven nor hell, let the hours drift by, watch the eagle fly. Oh life, oh life, you're such a crazy precious thing. Oh life, oh life, you're breaking my heart, then you make it wanna sing.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.